soul. Seminar returning, ancient path in the stars. The light of life inside us is lit by the same spark. When we lose our way, think there's nowhere left to turn. As our all around, we can always return. Water so deep, water so wide, water braiding the earth and the sky. Mountains so strong, mountains so tall, lifted by spirit.
What's good? My name is Charity Croft.
Howdy, player. I'm Jake.
Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Show here on KZFR 90.1 FM. I'm your host today, Guillermo Mash. The Black Friday Show. I'm calling it going green, traditional ecological knowledge. And that bumper song that Dan played is the one we're going to go out with. It's just one of the most beautiful things I saw all year. It's a viral video that a good friend of mine and a friend of the community and a friend of the natives, Jesse and Naomi, put together with two people from native tribes, three women, and they rise up from the water. And it's just a beautiful way to segue into what I'm calling the Unsuppressing of Knowledge show. And we've got a really powerful, powerful thing set up for you here today. We're going to have Allie Matters Knight, the reigning Butte Environmental Council Environmentalist of the Year and Traditional Ecological Knowledge Lecturer, and as well as Mel Figueroa, who is a geography PhD candidate from Berkeley, and a friend of mine, man, Ross Brannon. I can't be more proud of this young man. He's a wildland firefighter. But once again, I want to welcome you to the Black Friday, the Traditional Ecological Knowledge Show, and give thanks to all that we have. I mean, it's to me, it's a thanks, and it's a giving season, and I'm giving you this show that I put together. A lot of love and a lot of blood and a lot of sweat and tears. I want to give Jan's story real quick. Jan is someone who's a homeless elderly person downtown I've known since I've been in Chico. And she hit me up. She's looking for a place. You know, she'll just sleep under somebody's carport. And, you know, if you got some, WOAROOF@yahoo.com. And the only other thing I'll say is, you know, I'm hoping to end this with a special guest. And the code word for my special guest is, we need more cowbell. Anytime I say special guest, I don't want to tell people who it is. And then that way when they show up, you know, they feel bad or someone goes, how come you didn't show up? You were supposed to be special. So anyway, we hope we have a special guest later. And if not, we'll roll with it. But I want to start off with, I found this on Allie Matters Knight. This is on her Facebook page in the lead up to Thanksgiving Day. And no further ado, you'll hear what this is all about here on People Powered Radio.
What's good? My name is Charity Croft.
Howdy, player. I'm Jacob Dentel.
And happy day of mourning!
You mean Thanksgiving?
Exactly, happy Thanksgiving.
What is day of mourning, Charity?
I'm glad you asked. So you remember Plymouth Rock, where the Pilgrims settled in the New World and started Thanksgiving? Well, yeah, still to this day, there are Native Americans that live there, and they don't celebrate Turkey Day. Instead, they starve themselves as protest against the horrible people that slaughtered millions upon millions of their ancestors and then had the nerve to create a holiday thanking God for that. Here's the real Thanksgiving story. What we now know as Thanksgiving is actually a European knockoff of a feast called Nicomosashmiowene, created by the Wampanoag tribe that still lives in Plymouth, Massachusetts to this day. English settlers came around 1614 to their land and brought diseases that wiped out 90% of the indigenous population before the Mayflower even came. When the Pilgrims finally did come, they knew absolutely nothing about farming or survival and had the worst winter ever and almost died. As a matter of fact, the first thing they did when they got there was rob the graves of the Wampanoag and steal as much of their winter food as they could carry. Now, of course, the natives were pissed and wanted to get the Pilgrims out of there. But then the Pilgrims took out their fancy muskets, pointed them at the tribes, and told them that King James, the editor of the Bible, would like to sign a peace treaty with them. Well, this treaty was signed by the natives. But still yet, in 1637, the Europeans forced 600 members of the Pequot tribe to put down their weapons and convert to Christianity. The natives did just that. And once they sat their weapons down, the Europeans slaughtered all of their new brothers in Christ, then had the first annual Thanksgiving to celebrate their victory. Damn, Daniel back at it again with the white power. But we should be used to this, right? I mean, the first national celebration of Thanksgiving was called for in 1789 by, you guessed it, George Washington, the sweet guy who brought you the idea of manifest destiny. If you don't know what that is, it's the idea that it was the founding fathers' God-given right to murder the entirety of the continent so that they could shine from sea to shining sea. So yeah, here's a secret. There's a correlation between European Christianity and ruling the world. There's a correlation between white patriarchy and ruling the world. Gee willikers, Batman, who'd have guessed it?
Not me.
So yeah, while you devour your turkey legs, the indigenous people of this country will be mourning. To remember Thanksgiving is to remember death, and not only is it to remember death, but the more dangerous notion is that it is to thank God for giving us the supreme right to dominate and to kill, and somehow imagine that God supported us in these conquests. And I know what you're thinking.
So what do you want us to do? Just sit here and feel guilty about what our forefathers did? Stop living in the past. That has nothing to do with today.
No, you're right. It has nothing to do with today, except literally everything. You do realize that just last year there was national press covering an enormous protest, the one at Standing Rock with the Sioux tribe. They were being bitten by dogs, pepper sprayed, trying to keep toxic pipelines out of their water, off of their sacred grounds. Well, just about a week ago, those same pipelines that they're worried about actually leaked. 210,000 gallons of that protested oil leaked in South Dakota. I mean, how many groups have to be formed? How many protests have to be had? How many knees have to be taken in order to see the correlation between these injustices? It's this do-what-thou-wilt mentality without an ounce of empathy for the next. It's this sense of divine entitlement and inability to see that same divinity within others. Whether it be Columbus Day, Thanksgiving, or the Star Spangled Banner, we have this obsession with celebrating white dominance and demeaning the resistance against it. Sometimes it's a conscious effort, but most of the time, we don't even realize we're doing it. So here's one last interesting thought about Turkey Day. You ever thought about the fact that the primary way this holiday is celebrated is by eating? And sure, we have dinner on Christmas and a bunch of other holidays, but Thanksgiving in a very specific way is celebrated just by eating. And not just normal consumption, but food in extreme excess. People look forward to this day. It is that one time a year where it is socially acceptable to engorge yourself beyond your stomach's capacity. It is a holiday of gluttony. It is a holiday of literally taking more than you need. It is a holiday of taking more than you need and thanking God for your ability to do that. But I mean, take it for what it is. Spend time with your family, eat, because with our busy American lifestyles, we rarely get the opportunity to do that. I mean, and you know what they say, families only really get to come together on holidays and funerals. Just remember that this holiday is also kind of a funeral. We're about to go eat with our mom so they don't get mad. I love you.
All right. Taking more than you need and thanking God for it. I can't come up with a better way to put a wrap on that. And I just thank you for that. That I'm going to back announce that. I don't have that in front of me because people that know how community radio works, I do everything. I've actually answered the phone and done a bunch of other things. I'm actually juggling bowling pins right now. It's amazing. You should be here. Anyhow. I want to make an announcement here. Mel Figueroa is one of our guests on the show. She did a really killer follow-on to this. Originally, in my executive producer mind, I was going to follow right on with Mel Figueroa to kind of localize this. We didn't have time for the whole extended interview. However, due to the magic of my IT background, when you go and look at the archive, which we will be posting, it's going to be just like she aired. So anyway, you'll be hearing Mel at the end. We're going to end with a bang and the traditional ecological knowledge interview that I hosted with Mel and Allie will be the end of our show. But here on the front end, I want to make sure that folks know, you know, what we got going on. But I should probably do a shout out for underwriters. Let's get that out of the way. Peace and Social Justice is made possible. Generous contributions, KCFR supporters, and by local seasonal and organic delights at Farm Star Pizza. Love Farm Star Pizza. I'm giving them my plug because the farmer's the star there. Farm Star features artisan pizza, salads, appetizers, desserts, and they have vegan and gluten-free offerings, as well as craft beer and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner, with live music every Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. located in the Chico at 2359 the Esplanade. You can also find Farm Star Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. And shout out for me. I mean, they're an amazing supporter of our local music scene. Farm Star, we love you. And we do a lot of our KZFR events there. So KZFR loves you. And by Sonia Herring, a local Allstate insurance agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and their goals. Whether you're protecting your life, home, auto, boat, or motorcycle, Sonia Airy can help. They also do 401k rollovers. Sonia can be reached by calling or texting 345-2351. Anyway, Guillermo Mash here, hosting the Traditional Ecological Knowledge Show. And we're going to be featuring a lot of words and wisdom and passion from the Butte Environmental Council, or I'm calling it reigning because it sounds cool, the reigning environmentalist of the year, 2019. We'll have another one next year, and that'll be a high bar to set. But anyway, I'm going to jump in here and with the pre-records we've done for the show, and I want to thank everyone for listening and being part of Peepout Radio. It's such an awesome first story theme for our imagining community, which is a grassroots media and civic engagement organization broadcasting stories that make our community imagination sparkle and engage. And our purpose is to enlighten, nurture, and expand community engagement. So bottom line, we're putting together a content team that's going to be telling some long-form stories. So we're not just going to meet with someone once or twice. We're going to be covering the story for a couple of months, maybe even 3 months at a time. And along the way, we're going to be delivering audio, professional audio, video podcast that'll be detailing our story. And that's going to start in January for the work that we're doing in December. We're also going to be doing doing broadcasting both of those podcasts with a live discussion with young folks on Youth for Justice. We're also putting together a cadre of folks with skill sets like mine and others, putting together to do letters, guest comments, and columns in local print media. And the thing that's drawn me the most in this project idea I had, is the writing piece of it. So I'm committing to write some really detailed essays around what we learn following these stories. And also we'll have in the 21st century, we'll have social media for the written word, the photos, and the video and audio work that we're going to be doing here over the coming months. But our first story is actually going to be outlined here with Allie Matters Knight. I like to say the reigning Butte Environmental Council Environmentalist of the Year and a traditional ecological knowledge lecturer. And we're going to outline, you know, what kind of stories we need to be looking at.
You know, one thing I forgot to include in that, and it's important because that's my hopeful special guest, is we're putting together monthly community meetings around the stories we're telling. And the story of traditional ecological knowledge, we'll be telling this for 2 or 3 months. And in the Allie Matters Knight interview you're going to hear just here in a second, once I quit talking, she mentions how 100 million Native Americans were part of the Christian white patriarch genocide. And, you know, I'd reached out to her to find out what the actual source for that was. And she put The Canary Effect, which is a wonderful documentary film that I'll tell you more about towards the end of the show if I have time. But I can say I reached out to Allie and said, hey, let's air this thing in public space and I'll hope that you can help us put together a panel. And she put, yes, let's do it. Yes, let's do it is probably the best description to describe Allie Matters Knight. And you're going to see why I think that's a really good description. Allie Matters Knight, let's do it here on People Power Radio.
All right, we're back with Allie Matters Knight here. And do a quick introduction for yourself, Allie Matters Knight, and tell us a little bit about who you are.
I'm Allie Matters Knight. I'm a Machupta tribal member from Chico, California. This is occupied Machupta territory all the way through Butte County up to Concow area in Oroville.
Nice. You know, I met Allie a year and some months ago. And that age-old thing, now everything's before the campfire, after the campfire. And this was before the campfire, but you did a wonderful mural down in San Francisco. So, you know, I was enamored with all the work that you were doing then, both as an environmentalist and a lecturer and a speaker, but your art as well. Why don't you kind of give a bit of detail on the murals and different types of art you do and basket weaving and just like do it all.
Yeah. So art is actually kind of, it's been something from my childhood, and it's also been something I've carried with me as an outlet just to get through things, as most artists do. It's an expression of myself. But I have been doing art since I was in high school, actually, since I was in elementary school, really wanted to get into Virginia Commonwealth University when I was back east, and I did get accepted to the Fine Arts College, and I had to build a whole portfolio to accommodate that. And once I got in, I ended up moving to California, Chico, California. And,
glad to have you.
Yeah, thank you. It took me years to kind of build a new portfolio for this area and what I wanted to do. I had a lot of skill sets and I had a lot of knowledge to do different types of art from my training. There was an experience I had to go through with the colonization and being native from this area, being an indigenous from this area, and meeting so many people that didn't know who Machupta were, other than it may have been a residential hall on campus. So there was this historical kind of burning, like it would burn a little bit when people would tell me, oh, wow, Machupta, I grew up my whole life here and I've never heard of the Machupta. Huh. Yeah. And so I really felt in my heart it was because there was all these art of John and Annie Bidwell and all of this artistic representation from a completely different culture. So it took some time, but I was able to get certain pieces put in, starting at 20th Strip Park, that's now Martin Luther King Park. There was a doorway, Native American doorway. I was able to help design that to reflect the local culture. Verbena Fields, there's artwork out there that I had done with the children. That's their creation story. I'm working on West 2nd and Cedar, which is a huge 110-foot mural of a cedar, wow, of a village scene. There's more projects coming underway. I also one at Chico State, a big, huge canvas artwork that's done for tribal relations at Chico State for a village scene. So these are just things I've done locally to counterbalance some of the things that I heard earlier and kind of push myself as an artist to show that there needs to be representation of the local community and the local natives. Because for years, I would just drive through Yuba City and Marysville, and I would see one dancer, a tribal dancer, in the corner on a bridge. And it would just mean so much to me to see one image that was of our culture, that and it stood out. So to have more of that and more of that is what I see is necessary. So I can't necessarily do work that explains genocide and the pain. It's this god-awful mural. So I'd have to create something that was more palatable and still send the message that we're still here and be able to give the message of the restitution that is necessary for us to move on as a community.
Yeah, maybe the best way I can kind of personalize it as a non-Native American is I did this hike. I think it was Mount Tam. I should have back checked this, but one of the Bay Area hikes. I lead a hiking group. This is about 10 years ago. But we get to the top, Allie, and there's a museum, and they have this whole little section about how happy the Indians were to leave their sacred mountain and be put on a reservation. They told this just whole whitewashed, like, oh, I'm so glad the Americans, the colonizers took their land because they're so much better off. It was just abhorrent. And I was talking to this woman that was in the hiking group, and she got really angry and defensive. She said, they deserve to be put on reservations. I said, what do you mean? She said, they were savages. They were savage people. And I'm really having a dialogue with her. And I said, I'm sorry you have so much trouble with that. I said, how do you know they were savages? She says, oh, I can read. But she had this whole, you know, story that had been told to her that it was helpful that we unsavaged the Indians and we moved them elsewhere because they weren't really human. What can you add to that? Because it was really offensive to me. It still is offensive to me.
It's very perplexing to look at a cute, you know, fragile, you know, white lady who's been, you know, believed to be educated and very well off. And for me to look at her and think that she is completely savage, that she is just cutthroat savage, and that she has a cold heart and she has been raised with an immense amount of ignorance and confusion and lack of sense of seeing God in people. You see no God in me? You see no God in people? Well, what is a human miserable experience? So I try not to double up on that and make it worse for that person's experience to really see me as savage and like take it all the way. So it takes quite an amount of patience and tolerance to just know that there's been a generation of, you know, that were raised and grown in the United States to believe in a very, very racist, mean. And they hopefully those generations will die off soon. It's the only hope I have.
You know, one other thing to add to that, just to get some contrast to it, is once again, it's a hiking the land. Yeah, I did a lot of hiking American River down, you know, where Native Maidu Indians. But a dear friend of mine, who's part of the Sierra Club and is just an outdoorsman and big time, he had this book. It's called Bogus Thunder by Gene Markley. And I have an audio recording of this somewhere, I believe. But he starts to read from Bogus Thunder. And this was a man, Gene Markley was an educator, and he wrote a bunch of little small info books about the history of the American River and how Indians were murdered to get access to the gold. But it really was a tale that was told somewhat like this. And the Christians would go to church in the morning, and they'd all meet and have their lunch and celebrate, and then they would go out and kill Indians. They would go out and shoot Indians. And that was research that he did, you know, from Placer County. And I think they were able to justify that in their Christian belief or whatever belief they had, is this whole savage thing again, because these people were savages. That was really offensive to me too. I'm like, wow, go to church, have lunch, and then go out and shoot Indians, and then repeat it the next week.
Yeah, and I even went to a lecture with a Chico State professor at the library who was doing a lecture to the community about natives and his paleo, his assertion as a studious professor who was non-native and fully white. And he had no problems explaining that natives from 1850 or 1840s prior to white contact are definitely labeled prehistoric.
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 How does it feel as a tribal member to be, you know, identified as prehistoric?
I really label it to being primitive and Neanderthal. I could definitely see why people, it excites the Christian to believe they've done something right when they've been able to say you killed a primate who was not evolved, a human evolved, like a deficient human who wasn't as elite and who didn't evolve with European class and structure. Very ignorant, by far, something I would think would be something completely devastating after you died to realize was a lie.
Yeah, it's definitely a lack of communication, because the Native Americans certainly knew a lot more about how to take care of the land, right? Because if you're the colonizers, I like your term, because it really puts a spin on it. We're here to take your land. They're not so much interested in propping the Indians up for all of their knowledge. They want you to think that they're prehistoric people. They're, you know, just came out of the cave, and we're here to help them. We're going to give them Christianity, and, well, we'll kill a few of them along the way. That's how I look at it.
Collateral damage.
Collateral damage.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a tough story to be telling the day after Thanksgiving, but, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I've been to Plymouth Rock Alley, and I've been actually in that area where there's a tribe that actually still lives in Plymouth, in the Plymouth Rock area, and they ain't celebrating Thanksgiving, because this isn't a happy time when you look at what happened to the natives in this country.
It's not. And even in this area, we really haven't appreciated the massacres and the things that's happened recently. Even to this day, there's somebody who, we do the Gnome Cult Walk, but there's somebody who would like to do his own version of these Pence Ranch kids that were killed and their story about who killed them and why they had to slaughter so many Indians in this area in order to save all of the white children. And then they formed a group called the Supreme Order of Caucasians here in Chico. And these were a murderous, racist group, and they still have pretty much a similar following today with a group of citizens that have a very similar mindset that they're being invaded by a minority or people that don't belong here, and they have to remove them. And it cycles here very often. And it never really quite hits people that, you know, we look at the genocide in the United States with Native Americans. And I say Native because I'm naming all the tribes on this whole island.
Right.
We're talking about 100 million people dying as a form of genocide. You would look at the Holocaust in Germany. We're not looking at 100 million, but that's the label that United States has on just one specific area, just natives, just Native Americans, not talking about any other country around the world, but just here at home, 100 million natives had to die for this to make America what it is today. And if that's not the closest thing to Jesus Christ, I don't know what is.
Yeah, you know, they like to talk a lot, too, about the forefathers, Allie. I mean, the forefathers had slaves, and they said women can't vote. You know, the whole suffrage movement that went on into the 20s. So, you know, I think we need to be honest and true to ourselves. The other thing I'll say, I guess some comments, is when I was younger, like from early preteen all the way into, like, early 30s, Westerns. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And nearly every single Western just portrayed the Indians as savages, just savages, and then people that were out there to just kill the white folk. And then they had a show that I used to watch because it was funny, but it wasn't funny in a way because these are white actors with red paint, or they made them look stupid, like F Troop.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have seen F Troop, right? Mm-hmm. And they make these Indian folks out to be bumbling fools who are just so happy to have the military there so they can, you know, not be as stupid as people, you know, are seeing them. You know, looking back now, it's really offensive. I mean, what could you? How offensive is it to you as a Native American?
I mean, I'm a white person. Even Dances with Wolves was offensive in a way where I was like, why is Kevin Costner the white hero here? Why does every Native, why does every Native film have to have some white hero that comes and saves us? He's really a colonizer who just got misunderstood, this one guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it just get it's very aggravating. And but I think that that's why using art here locally has been such a it's been a game changer, because people are looking at it like, are you putting up art representing the Machupta tribe and asking questions about it, putting up the language? And it's effective because it's local, it's here, and it does counterbalance some of these historical movies and these historical images that don't belong, and possibly start talking about the role that Annie Bidwell and John Bidwell played in oppressing and carrying out the genocide against the local tribal folks, instead of giving them this legacy of beautiful intentions. And I've said that, you know, John Bidwell's great intentions paved the way for where he is right now.
Hell.
Exactly.
Yeah. Folks just joining, we are speaking with Allie Metters Knight, the reigning Butte Environmental Council Environmentalist of the Year and an instructor for traditional ecological knowledge. But I'm going to transition here, Allie. You're our... Yeah, I'm going to transition actually to the top of the hour, and we're really happy to have all the listeners that we have out there and all the supporters. Such a wonderful thing. I told Allie and Mel on the way out the door, I said every community should have a community radio station. It is such a powerful, uplifting thing to be able to give people a voice, give people a place to play music, give people a place to be seen and heard. And with that, I would say the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And you are listening to FM 90.1. KZFR, Chico, listener-supported community radio, Sacramento Valley, foothills, and beyond. And this show, Peace and Justice, made possible generous contributions of supporters and listeners, and by Tim Kemper, a mortgage specialist with Guild Mortgage. Tim is a longtime supporter of KZFR and specializes in first-time home buyers and reverse mortgages. To learn more about how Tim can make your home your dreams come true, visit Tim Kemper, that's KEMPERLOA. Loans, timkemperloans.com, or call, give him a call. I'm sure he'd love to pick up a call. 530-377-3954. Once again, 530-377-3954. MLO number N977542. And by the Naked Lounge, locally owned since 2001 at 118 West 2nd Street in the heart of downtown Chico. Naked Lounge supports local art, music, and features naked coffee, Chico Chai, Tin Roof Bakery, and near and dear vegan baked goods. The lounge is open 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. and has a rotating selection of canned beers and live music on occasion. Find them on Facebook. More details. I'm using my memory, so, you know, I'm pretty sure it's salient, though. You know, I'll do a shout out because tomorrow Naked Lounge is doing this whole thing. I think Jason Cassidy, CNR, put it together, and it's going to be a benefit for Safe Space. And as I play this clip, I'm going to find out more so I can tell you more, because I always like to support the local music scene, and I certainly want to support Safe Space. Back to the interview with Allie Metters Knight here on Beatbox Radio. Our first story, we've got this new group we put together called Imagining Community, and it's a grassroots media and civic engagement organization broadcasting stories that make our community imagination sparkle and engage. And we're here to enlighten, nurture, and expand community engagement. So how that rolls out is we're going to be, myself and other journalists and other people that are on the creative team, we're going to be telling long-form stories. We're going to follow this for a couple of 2 or 3 months and do audio-video work around it and some written word. So the question I have for you around that whole mouthful there was, you know, what is the story to be told these next few months, Allie? Where should we be pointing our cameras and our microphones and our pens?
So right now, I believe that it is time for us to take action. The last time, few times I've spoken, done a presentation on working on creating a 20-year land management contract to the federal government, I've had to explain to people that, and it sounds a little bit morbid, but very honest, there's no other way to say it, my dead self is talking to my live self saying, do it now.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have to do now is wake up at least people around me to help support me at this point, and then get a big bunch of support to go ahead and get the community involved in doing restoration of our forests and to actually bring money in the next 20 years into this community by working on the land, by working on our forests and creating knowledge that we can pass down for generations, because we need to have survivable ecosystems here during climate change. And I definitely think it's possible that our community can band together and do this and represent what other communities can do throughout the nation by supporting Indigenous folks, by collaborating with their tribal neighbors, and giving the tribes the authority to manage the land and to make it an actual economy using everything in the forest.
Everything in the forest, and the forest is bountiful.
Very.
I spent a lot of time in the forest as a kid. I'll never forget, it was back when Google Earth first heard it. It's like the 2000. I was telling my friend how I have these wonderful memories as a young boy in the woods of New Hampshire. And I said, all it was trees. He said, let's look it up for Google Earth. And at least 20 years ago, I felt so happy, Allie, because we looked it up and there was just hundreds of miles, square miles of nothing but trees, right? The forest. So I've been connected with the forest and the water since a little kid. So this really, I'm enamored to this whole thing of getting more connected over the next few months. And speaking of getting connected, you know, we talked about, you know, and I really appreciate your words around, you know, what kind of stories we need to be looking at. What kind of organizations do you think we'll be intermingling with or reaching out to or also being part of this project?
So I believe that the Fire Safe Council to put an insert in the last CNR about the forest health and all the programs and projects we've worked on. So I think we should be working. They've done such an excellent job with collaborating and partnering with everybody and sustaining such good relationships. I would like to go that as a tribal member and working with the tribe, I'd like to go after funding to make that a huge collaboration and a huge project. And I'd love to have them talk about their story of how they collaborated through all these years and survived and created such an inspiration for me that I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I've come this far and I feel very impressed with the Fire Safe Council beyond words. And I really like to point some fingers at them and say, listen to what they have to say.
And Don Hankins is part of that, correct?
Don Hankins as well. Yes. He's part of the Fire Safe Council.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else come to mind? Or we'll just kind of dovetail off of that maybe once we start talking to the Fire Safe Council.
Yeah, I think Cal Fire is like a really good start with other tribes in the area, and they have done traditional ecological knowledge, TEK. And I haven't really collaborated with them as far as south here, north of here, yes. But they usually speak for themselves and they get into their certifications in their local area and in their territory. So within this Matupta territory, we also have a really good opportunity for the students at Chico State, the students at Paradise High School, the students within our community to have a great opportunity to learn more than just what they have collegially within their classrooms. We can have classrooms outside for them. And that's what I'm excited about, too.
I'm excited, too. And I think it's important for, I guess, folks like me. I love to kind of word it that way because most people have just, you know, outside looking in knowledge for many things in this world. We can't know everything. But for me, you know, this whole Matupta tribe, Chico chapter, you know, that's not even the correct term, Chico chapter. I want to make sure that, you know, at the end of this 2 or 3 months, Allie, that our listeners and maybe some viewers understand what the Menchupta tribe is and what their history is and what they bring to the table as far as restoring and imagining a community here in Butte County.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of history. When I came out in 1993 and started studying it, I had just as innocent and colonized mind than anybody else. So I had a lot to learn. I had a lot of growing to do. I had a lot of places to go. I had a lot of embarrassing comments that I didn't understand and I asked questions about, especially about colonization and whether it all had to happen for a reason. And I've discovered that it shouldn't have happened and that there was a lot of ignorant killers that were allowed to do what they did. And there was a moment that there was thought that there was no reconciliation. But ignorance upon ignorance upon ignorance is now killing everybody on the floor right here on the valley floor, not only through chemicals, but through poor management of ecosystems, through dredging, through mining, and now through suppression of fire and just suppression of indigenous knowledge. So the more we resist and push back and don't break open that history mm-hmm. and look at it for what it is, then we're kind of resisting the knowing the Menchupta folks and how this worked out. So knowing how many 250,000 Menchupta were here in the early 1800s and how fast the population went down and how vulnerable they were once they survived epidemics, that to see crews of people come and kill and scalping them and having the only protection to be working for a white rancher, and this is after the Civil War, I think people have a hard time wrapping their minds around that. And so the history of the Menchupta is that of somebody who is probably your most wisest, oldest neighbor that's probably been the most abused, neglected, and hurt, but very resilient, very, very kind, and still willing to work with everybody to make it better, because it's not so much bygones be bygones. It's that our children live together. Our grandchildren are going to live together. So we must show them how to do it.
I really am enamored with those two words you put together, suppressing knowledge. I mean, I can't come up with a better word to describe, you know, what's been transpiring in the last 20, 30 years. Maybe I come from the golden age of knowledge, but when I was younger, knowledge was king. You know, you really felt good that you kind of had the facts and you felt proud to kind of looked at, you know, what was going on. But all along, there's been a suppressing of knowledge. And I think we're in the age of suppression of knowledge. We're in the age of all facts. This isn't true. That isn't true. And it's really detrimental to the community at large and specifically, you know, folks that are, you know, coming back out of this campfire or folks that have been living off the land here for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You know, coming from a place of historical knowledge, the suppression of knowledge, is not so much even in our school systems. It's also, yeah, in our radio stations, on our television. It's even at our dinner tables when we speak. A lot of community members that I speak to, I do lectures and I talk about the historical genocide that took place here. And you know, I get very sharp tongued when I speak of colonizers.
Yeah,
and
you should.
And
there's some anger there.
Yeah,
there should be. Yeah.
And there is some resistance. And sometimes the resistance is basically that, how can I feel bad now for what happened to your ancestors when you're doing fine now, I'm doing fine now, and that's in the past. And it's almost like a complete gaslighting with like an abuser with such a defensive posture that I tend to want to believe that it's important for me to keep going and just reinforcing that history, because eventually those people will break.
Yeah.
They will break under the fact that they can no longer argue that it's irrelevant. If I carry, I carry the genocidal pain in my heart,
yeah,
even if I don't want to, but even a colonizer carries genocidal pain in their heart for being a killer.
Yeah, I believe that.
You
absolutely
can't. We don't escape it, so we can only heal together.
I think comparing it to the genocide that the society actually learned from is Germany. They called it reconciliation. They said, "Hey, we did some really stupid things," and they have monuments that talk about how stupid they were, and they have real rigid rules and laws that we're not going to talk about fascism and Nazis again. And here in this country, we went the opposite direction after the Civil War. You know, we're going to raise monuments to the Confederates because that's part of our history. But as a nation, we have never reconciled not only the Native Americans, but also all of the slavery and suffrage. We never stopped to say, you know, we want to reconcile this and make sure it doesn't happen again. And that's what feeds this over and over again, this ignorance. And it's systematic. They want people to be ignorant. And so then that way, when they tell them something stupid, they're like, oh, that sounds just right to me.
We get into the hundreds of years they were killing Indians. Mm-hmm. Hundreds.
Hundreds of years.
People believe, oh, it only happened for a little blip of time. Mm-hmm. But you're looking at, what, 1400s contact on the East Coast? And then you have, what, 1863? They're still slaughtering all the way over here in California. So almost 400 years of slaughtering people. You can't just undo all that ignorance.
Yeah, I want to do a shout out to let people know this is Peace and Social Justice Show, host Garen Womash. You are listening to Machupta Tribal member Allie Manners Knight and the Butte Environmental Council Environmentalist of the Year and Traditional Ecological Knowledge Lecturer and Artist and so many other things. Just like most humans, Allie's got a wide breadth of a persona. But I do want to make note that you can hear a lot of emotion, you know, pain in Allie's voice. And it was something I could see as a journalist actually interviewing her. You know, this is something near and dear to her heart, and it's part of why she's dedicated her life. And I really feel blessed to know her and to know that she's got this let's do it attitude. So let's do it. Let's finish this interview here on People Power Radio. Cam.
And it's hard, but I am not going to stop, but mm-hmm. I am definitely undeterred.
It still continues. Not only the ignorance and the suffrage and the you know, all of this genocide, and that's a big word. Hundreds of, you know, millions of people that were physically killed. But where I was going with that is it's still used as a blunt tool now. Because it's like, I like the whole traditional ecological knowledge. If you'd have called it an indigenous knowledge, you'd have all of this built up hundreds of years of, oh, we shouldn't listen to those savages.
Well, I think, like I said, some of the generations that are very, you know, I would say, I call them John Wayne, John Wayne's racists against natives, they're kind of dying off. So their voices is not as clear. We do have we do have the neoliberal, what you call neo-Nazis type Proud Boy, right. White supremacists today.
And in Germany, this wouldn't happen. It's against the law.
They're very, they have their strengths and weaknesses. Most gang affiliations, most powerfully criminally, they have big power in prisons. So they're actually the guards of the prisons because there's a small population of white inmates as there is. So your police, your prison guards are pretty much supporting a lot of the white supremacy that takes place in all the agencies across the United States. Mm-hmm. It's pretty common knowledge. So they're not quite John Wayne. They're definitely indifferent and not even looking on the radar for natives. They have already basically swallowed the pill, the matrix pill of that every native was killed and dead. So that's why you're going to have people like Bill Connolly on the Board of Supervisors who are just going to say, Machupta, those Indians died a long time ago. The Indians today are totally different. As if that's like stating the obvious of something strange, but actually he's talking about how white supremacy natives is that they did kill every one of us. The genocide was completely successful and we're all gone and they don't even look at us. So the other generations are folks that are saying, we know racism is wrong. We know this country is founded on lies and some screwed up principles. We're going to straighten up those principles. We're going to talk about those principles and we're going to keep coming to the table until we get this right. We're going to bring people of color. We're going to bring people with different backgrounds who speak different languages to speak for other people so that we get a better picture, a bigger picture, and a real picture of how we can acculturate this nation instead of assimilate everybody into this very strange, racist, narrow-minded, knowledge-suppressed type box. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I see it, is that we really just have to work with the folks that are open-minded, who aren't racist, and we're going to have to just move, almost like ignore everything around us that are screaming no and push forward.
That was so honest. I mean, are open-minded and not racist. I mean, oh, you actually have to have be open-minded to be, not be racist,
yeah.
Right? And there's just so many people that have, that are, that fall into these stereotypes. It's hard to break that down. All people are good and decent. I think there's all people, even the colonizers, as you would word it. There's a good and decent kernel, and you just kind of help, you know, conjure that out. Maybe one thing to land on real quick, and before we do closing comments, this is age old. It's not my quote, but it's like, if you find that you're all on the same hill screaming the same things, you know, maybe you need to find a new hill. And I think so often people that are open to looking at the truth and knowledge feel like if they do, they can't stay on that hill. But my comment is maybe you're on the wrong hill anyway, and maybe there's a better hill for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And than the racist, misogynist, and so, genocide hill. It's probably a better hill.
They
for
can
you.
Say they have that hill. I want to give them that mountain.
Yeah,
definitely,
keep that mountain.
That
yeah.
mountain is overgrown. It's got fire suppression. They don't know how to tend to the land around it, so they can have that hill. And that's why I think it's really important that I'm looking at forest health and looking at the environment and ecosystem, a 20-year contract with the federal bill that Trump signed and was signed by LaMalfa and all of the other people that are going to have to support it because they signed this bill and it happens to support Native folks. I'm just sure they didn't see it coming, but.
Well, they might have started coming and go, oh, we've got hundreds of years of history of how we can just suppress the Native Americans. Let's just sign whatever bill we want because we're going to screw them anyway.
Well, they also
maybe being too negative, but
It was the indifference. They didn't believe that could happen, you know, so they actually are not opposing. So there's not a bunch of people stopping you from fixing the forest, you know, because they're racists. I mean, it's almost like I got a really great chess move right now because there's no reason to chase me while I'm handling this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no threat.
Especially in Butte County.
Especially in Butte County. There's no threat to that. So it's kind of strategically finding also where we can have common ground. Because when we do forest management, I'm going to be working with loggers. I'm going to be working with every piece of the community from every color, from every creed. And there are going to be some white supremacists there. There are going to be some racist folks. There's going to be some non-racist folks that are open-minded. There are going to be some folks that never even heard
of
Machupta.
A lot of hills.
A lot of hills. But I think this is the great where we work together and make those changes. When we work together to fix the land, going to change a lot.
The hills are alive with the sound of restoration.
There it is.
There it is. We can come up with a whole reach and do a whole sound of the music, like take off on
I
that.
I like it.
All right. I'm really looking forward to this project. Any closing comments for our listeners here on the Black Friday Peace and Social Justice Show?
I hope it wasn't too harsh. I tend to be a little angry when I talk about colonizers. I even told somebody to, we need to change the general plan of Chico. And our plan, any type of plan that quotes Annie Bidwell on ecology. Annie Bidwell was a colonizer. She had no understanding of the ecology of this area. And she's simply donated land that she should have given back to the Machupta tribe, but instead gave it to the citizens of Chico, gave us a couple $100 after she died. And I think it's important that my legacy is to take her name
right
out of the ecology and out of the general plan of this town and put Machupta's name instead.
Yeah, I think that's whole part of that, the social construct to kind of suppress knowledge. It kind of like, I hope I wasn't too harsh because you were being honest, right? And the same thing happened with the Ross interview, which I'm not going to edit. He says, I don't want to get too political and maybe you want to edit this out. But he just basically stated a fact that the burns were from 9 to 1 in paradise and it's not a good idea. That gives you an understanding how systemic this is to put people's voices down so they feel fearful that they might be heard on the radio talking about how it's not a good idea in paradise just to have a 9 to 1 p.m. burn. Where I'm kind of going, truth is power, knowledge is power, and we need more of that. So, yeah, the hell with suppressing of knowledge. I'm looking for, you know, explosion of knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, I've talked before, and I've done decolonization workshops, and I've seen the faces and some of the things that I've had to say and how it hurts. And I said, I'm sorry, you know, I was like, I could see that I've hurt some people. Decolonization is uncomfortable, at least talking on a historical sense of decolonization. And so I was like, please go to your healing tent. So if I hurt anyone, I hope you have a healing tent.
And there you go. All righty, Allie Matters Nights. This has been a real joy, and thank you for coming on KZFR 90.1 FM. High five.
8290.
8290, I like that. 8290. I hope everyone that's listening is in their own little personal healing tent. That's a wonderful way to end the interview. And I got such a short amount of airtime. I got three different paragraphs I'm going to read. I'm going to pull one.
But I know Allie makes a point about the John Wayne people dying off. I'm going to relate to Clint Eastwood, the ultimate John Wayne with a gun. In his film Gran Torino, which is my choice for the best film ever made about racism and xenophobia, I believe, without giving spoilers, that we can all be like the character Clint played and be open-minded and take a stand that becomes apparent when he has the proximity to a young Latino neighbor who stole his Gran Torino. Watch that one. Watch that one in your healing tent. It's a beautiful story. And speaking of beautiful stories, I'm going to have Allie and Ross Brannon, a wildland firefighter, right now, on People Power Radio.
All right, Guillermo Mash here for the Black Friday edition of the Peace and Social Justice Show here on KZFR 90.1 FM. And I'm really pleased to do a pre-record here Wednesday before the Thanksgiving Day with Allie Meadors-Knight, the reigning Beck Environmentalist of the Year and Traditional Ecological Knowledge Lecturer, as well as Ross Brannon, a wildland firefighter. I think I'll start with you, Ross. Why don't you give our listeners just a little bit more background on Ross Brannon and how it relates to the work you do in the wildland forest fire suppression, and you put them out too.
Yes. I currently work for the U.S. Forest Service, and what we do, we'll go out, we'll do fuels reduction, we'll cut dead trees down, we'll cut fire breaks, typically meaning that we'll scrape the soil down to bare mineral to where the fire can't burn through dirt. Yeah, then we'll do prescribed burns, and we'll burn off all the dead stuff, do understory burns, just to promote a healthier forest.
What about you, Allie?
I'm a local Machipta tribal member, and so for the last 10 years explicitly, I've been teaching and trying to promote traditional ecological knowledge and working with Don Hinkins and CSUC to promote traditional fire, to bring fire back to the landscape of Butte County, and to teach children and the community the benefits of a healthy fire and a healthy ecosystem based on fire.
Well, nice. Why don't we land on that since we have a firefighter here? Why don't we talk a little bit about these prescribed burns and traditional burns and, you know, what that means for our community, our imagining community?
So imagining our community with a healthy fire is looking at healthy historical viewpoints on traditional knowledge, looking at the indigenous knowledge of fire and firescapes, landscapes, fire regimens as very intelligent, wise, made decisions for long-term, large-scale ecosystem health. And once we can kind of do the paradigm shift in our minds that natives were not primitive and undeveloped, but they actually had a great engineering idea for a huge landscape. And if we could go back and appreciate that and acculturate that knowledge into today's workforce, labor force, to bring in labor force into our forests and to bring people back into the landscapes where they need to be tending and doing restoration. Mm-hmm. I think that is what I see as the future of Butte County, a healthy fire and people, healthier people working on the landscape, doing restorative work to our ecosystems.
Yeah. And I invited Ross into this conversation because I've known Ross for about 5 years. We first met him at Youth for Justice in the Peace and Justice Center. Ross had this beautiful thing to say to me right after the Beck Gala, where Allie was recognized as the Beck Environmentalist of the Year. He said, you know, we really should be listening to the indigenous folks and using some of their practices out here in the wildland. So why don't you take it from there, Ross, and explain a little bit more of what you meant.
First and foremost, our most important firefighting tools are all things that the natives started doing. That's cutting fire breaks, prescribed burns. As far as fighting fire, those are the two most effective methods. Of course, you know, this was before aircraft were around, which most of the stuff's done on the ground. The aircrafts are there to help, but ultimately it's fought by men and women on the ground.
Now, what are some of those tools that you're looking? I know you're out there doing the work right now, Allie. What does some of these things look like as far as, you know, prescribed burns, traditional burns, maybe the difference between the two?
Well, I look at prescribed burns as more of accommodating CAL FIRE and some of the state and federal regulatory fire policies that have been laid out for almost hundreds of years here in California. Some of them do need to be reconsidered and looked at with an acculturation of indigenous knowledge. And then traditional burns are really like almost more casual and less fear-based. So there's less need to wear lots of equipment. There's less need to spend specialized teams of people digging very long. We could use deer breaks for, say, a break and a deer trail instead of a break, and to recognize that knowledge. And to also, maybe we don't have to do core samples of the earth to see if it's a good time to burn, which wastes good opportunity to do underscore burns. So the traditional burning is a lot more, I would say, laissez faire, like happy. Right. We're community oriented, where a prescribed burn is a lot more regiment, a little bit more military-like and policy. Mm-hmm. We can blend the two, and so, but definitely there is some distinctions between them.
So why don't you explain a little bit more about some of the traditional burns you've been on here in Butte County, Allie?
So I worked over the Butte College Ecological Reserve. It's on Big Chico Creek. And what was interesting thing first I noticed was I didn't have to wear all the equipment everybody else had to wear. I was able to wear boots and jeans and a t-shirt, and I was able to drop fire. I was able to make bundles to drop fire with other pieces of grass. I was working alongside other people that were wearing way more equipment. It was super hot. So I felt that freedom first and foremost. And then I also didn't feel so much fear. We did patches, so you kind of do levels, start a little bit at top and you kind of burn your way up. Fire tends to go all the way up. You're looking at lots of wind conditions, things you don't want things to get out of hand. Pine cones are fire bombs, so those are something that you particularly pay attention to, because once they catch on fire and roll downhill, they can be problematic. And same with dead logs. So there's just little things that you have to pay attention to, that perhaps on a regular day driving through traffic and going shopping, that you don't have to keep mindful of. But those are my experiences. And keep going back, you're seeing complete removal of star thistle. You're seeing beautiful grasses that are healthy. You're seeing water in the ground. There's moisture within 2 feet of the ground. And it's a complete different after the fire regimen than what it was there, which was you couldn't even walk through it without wearing a rubber suit at least 5 inches thick without getting ripped.
How big a swath of land are we talking about?
We're talking acres at a time.
Acres at a time up there at the Chico Ecological. That's Upper Bidwell, right?
Right, right. So you can now, on December 13th, they're going to have a demonstration, I think, if it's possible. But they're going to be walking through, showing everyone the burning regimen that took place over there. And it's taken over years. So I've been doing this probably, I was up there 7 years ago when I had, and they were filming up there when I was burning.
It's unfortunate that the best time to do burns as far as for the land is right here towards the, you know, the bulk of the fire season. You know, how could we elaborate on that?
Well, I think we have to understand what climate change really does to our ecosystems. Yeah. And so what that means is we have longer, drier seasons and shorter, very wet seasons. So, you know, the adaptation to that has been done traditionally here before. And so that's why I suggested a little bit less core sampling from the ground, because the best time to burn is almost the day you wake up and realize. You can't really find it on the farmer's almanac, because it wasn't proposed to be on a farmer's almanac, because that's very colonized. There almost has to be a very strong trust and awareness that we can read the environment for certain areas. Just say, for instance, if you have the dark side of a mountain, is a little bit colder, a little bit wetter, longer during the day, because the sun is not shining on it. It's on the shadow, it's on the shady part. So those types of areas are probably your first and best areas to burn first during at times. So there's always strategies you could use as long as you have the ability to burn.
One quick thing is core samples. For someone that is not familiar with core samples, which probably includes our listeners, what is that and why is it needed?
So you have a barometer. I'm sure someone's seen someone swing a little barometer around. It looks like they're just swinging their keys, looking cute. And then there's things where they have to dig in the ground and take a core sample of the soil to see how much moisture it is. Well, that's usually sent off to a lab. So there's not somebody right there with a scientist with a beaker and his little white coat handling that right there. It has to go. So you lose that moment.
Right, exactly. Okay. And listeners just joining, we are speaking with Allie Metters-Knight, the reigning Beck Environmentalist of the Year and Traditional Ecological Knowledge Lecturer, along with Ross Bannon, who is a wildland firefighter. But I thought it was a fascinating comment you made about the Farmer's Almanac, Allie. The Farmer's Almanac, we used to get that all the time. all the time. And the Farmer's Almanac knowledge is really based upon history, what happened 50 or 100 years ago. I'm really kind of fascinated to dig in a little bit to see how much climate crisis, climate change is upset the apple cart called the Farmer's Almanac, because how things were 100 years ago is completely out the window.
100 years ago, the weather is going to be completely different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we all understand that during this time when we weren't having fires for like 100 years, it was affecting the climate. So when you did fire suppression starting 100 years ago, then you're going to be affecting the climate. So there is going to be, there's my first wrench I'm going to throw on that, is that you didn't have fires, so you didn't have a normal climate 100 years ago.
Would you like to add to all that, Ross?
I would say that most of the fuels reduction work that we're doing is actually combating that the fire suppression that we've been doing for the last 100 years. Like, so we've been having to fix what we've done. Like last year, we had multiple fires that were over 100,000 acres out here in California. We had the Mendocino Complex, which was over 400,000. Like, everyone I was on last year was over 100,000. Obviously, all the suppression that we've done has really caused a pileup, and it's really causing things to change.
So from your vantage point on the ground, fighting fires and suppressing fires, Ross, what needs to change as far as shifting more to the indigenous way of looking at managing the land?
I would say that the methods that we use are predominantly indigenous anyways, but...
Such as?
Prescribed burns.
Okay.
Understory burns.
Understory burns, what is that?
It's where you have a bunch of dead branches.
Okay.
Just, you know, you burn off all the brush, like... It's crazy to see how the area next to a burn, and then like you have the area where it's checked off to where to an area that hasn't been burned yet, how clear it is that like we absolutely need to be burning off these understories, because like you go to from an area that's like it looks gorgeous, like it's gonna look nice in a year, and then you go to a place where it's just like you can't walk through it. There's no way.
You know, my first inkling of fire was happenstance. I was maybe 14 or 15, and by mistake, I started a grass fire. You know, I won't spend precious airtime giving you the riveting tales of a one-acre grass fire. But what was fascinating, not that very next summer, because it was in the late fall this happened with all the leaves, that whole area was just greener. It was healthier. You could literally see where that fire was. And that's the first time I kind of started going, fire's not so bad. Fire brings life.
I was walking with Don Hankins, and we were looking at the ecological reserve. And then we walked, I think we were in another area. Maybe we were at Butte Creek. And he said it was too bad that we couldn't burn. Cal Fire had called off a fire that we were going to do. And they called it off because it was too close to the campfire. And people were worried about the smell of smoke. And
the trauma, kind of like
trauma.
People.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we could have had rain 2 weeks ago because the smoke of certain fires actually attracts the clouds to make rain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another reason why it affects the weather, is actual smoke affects and brings clouds so that you would actually affect the weather. So there was a possibility that we could have brought a lot more rain and moisture during this extended fire season if we were allowed to burn.
And I don't want to get too political here. The sad reality is Paradise had restricted burn hours to where you could only burn from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. So what could you possibly burn off in that amount of time? Like, think of everything that wouldn't have happened had we... Like, or you have 10-minute fuels, one-hour fuels, so like 10-minute fuels, that would be your grass. You know, grass is going to burn off in 10 minutes. Things about under 1 inch, like those are your 1 hour fuels. And then you get up, I forget the specific numbers, but you get up to 10,000 hour fuels. Like there's things like if there's a dead tree, that's going to take probably between,
more than 4 hours.
Yeah.
A lot more.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can't burn off all the brush in your yard. You can't, you'll be lucky if you're able to burn off all the pine straw in 4 hours, realistically.
Contrasting to that traditional burn, how long do those burns last, Allie?
Oh, days.
days. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
I mean, and especially if the community is involved. So when I was in Orleans, California, and they had this TREX program, so it wasn't so much a traditional burn. It was a slightly more cultural and prescribed mix together. The tribal members all had hard hats and fire coats on just to accommodate. But other than that, there was a lot of traditional use of knowledge all through the night. So you could see through the night, go out on your porch and just see this small, thin red line that was creeping up the hill. And there was workers all around. So every path was thought out. They even used drones. They used all kinds of equipment to make sure they've navigated and they've got even... They even look at ivy and grapevines that have big roots because grapevines like to take the fire into the ground. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these fun things you get to learn where these are all documented and notified. So it takes days to assess and look at everything. And you recover stuff. There's a lot of cultural things to recover after a fire, not only, you know, after the sticks burn back, but twisty sticks, rocks. There's just all kinds of things that are missing and looked at. And yeah, it takes days to go through that. And it's usually fun.
And just to give another idea at like how long some of these burns can last. So the last thing I was on this year was a fire that was just above Quincy. And it had been burning since July when we got out there. And we got out there at the end of October. These smoke jumpers came out there. These two guys were watching and monitoring this fire that started from a lightning strike that eventually got up to like 7 acres and just kind of stayed there. They were observing it. We had a huge wind event where there were 60 mile per hour gusts. It didn't go anywhere. I would say the primary reason for that is there was already proper timber spacing there. There wasn't a whole bunch of dead stuff. Like, it looked like it had been treated before. However, they brought what's called a fire use module up there, which fire use modules, these guys are fully self-sufficient. It's pretty impressive. They bring all their own food. Like, they bring all this equipment to monitor fires. They're not fighting it. They just monitor it. So they called us in to cut line around this thing and increase the size of it to burn off the parts that would be beneficial. We tied the end of the line into an alder stand because alder doesn't burn. It's not gonna blow up. It might smolder, but it's not gonna burn. And so, finally, after 2 months of this thing burning, they put fire on the ground and it slowly burned off. And you know, I haven't checked the status of it. I would not be surprised if it's not 100% out right now. It's because it was creeping. But it's just, stuff can burn for a long time.
The term smoke jumpers, I've heard that a few times. Does that apply to these people that were just there monitoring the fire? Or what is a smoke jumper?
A smoke jumper, these guys parachute in, or they also have trucks that can drive to places. All these guys are certified to size up a fire and be the commander of the incident. That's what we call it. FEMA uses an incident command system, so they are at least IC5s or greater, which would be 4, and then all the way down to 1. But yeah, as an IC5, like, you can stay there by yourself without any extra overhead. You can monitor it. It's pretty much up to you to decide what to do, unless you get direction from someone higher up who's like, all right, here's what our goal is in this area. This is what we want you to do. We know you're qualified. And smoke jumpers usually have more qualifications than your usual firefighter.
Mm-hmm. How long you been firefighting? A few years? A couple of years?
Just 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
Not just. You've been fighting fires for 2 years. You've picked up a lot, Ross.
Well,
yeah.
I'm
impressed with you.
My boss is real old school. This guy has been doing this for like 30 years. Just like Allie said, like, why are we taking core samples? Like, if we have a window to burn, we need to burn. You know, that's the kind of stuff I picked up from my boss. Like, if you have an opportunity, you need to take it. Otherwise, we just, like, sit there and think our way out of our opportunity. And
right.
Then we got to wait again.
You would make an excellent technical creative resource for us, Ross, as we tell this story about natural burns and the prescribed burns. You up for that? We're gonna be working this for a couple of months.
Yeah.
I'd love to get up there on this December 13th thing. What's the deal on that again for our listeners? The December 13th
bar? December 13th. It looks like it's a full gig, but, you know, I always crash parties. it's at the Buick Ecological Reserve, and it's on fire, and it's going through all the fire regimens. I believe Pyrotech, Don Hankins, and I believe there's going to be three more up there. And so it's a kind of a lecture series and a walkthrough. We took the Paradise High School students through it before inviting them to come and burn. So they would like to burn too. It's kind of a healing learning session for them as well.
Folks, if I know how to get there, how do we get to the ecological preserve? Can you give good directions? You just keep going. So you can't go any further.
It's on Highway 32, and it's on the left, and yeah. I believe there's a marker.
Okay.
It is very spooky. You get dropped right off the road and go down to a deep canyon. You have to have some guts. It's paved halfway. There's dirt roads. I used to go out there all the time, so to me it's nothing, but every time I bring somebody new, they're like, oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
So get online. Get your Chico State University, Butte College Ecological Reserve. Get your MapQuest out, because you're going to need it, because if you don't know where the marker is, just by instinct and natural ways, it's almost like telling you it's near a rock.
Wow, this is adventurous. I like it already. What about you, Ross? You like this whole idea? Going out there on the 13th? I don't know if you're available on the 13th. I'd love to have you along.
I am available.
Boom, look at that. We're getting a whole production crew here
to
go out there and document this. I really like this. Any closing comments on this, on the burn aspect here of the traditional ecological knowledge before we break?
Well, I definitely think that we have an opportunity with the 2018 Farm Bill that was introduced. We have some openings for grants starting in August. So we're looking at possibly the tribe doing sole source contracting and subcontracting with everybody in the community after they're certified with TEK, so that we can basically manage all federal forests in Butte County and having every possible workforce eligible.
Who's we?
We is the tribe and we is the community. It's a partnership.
Oh, I love that. That's imagining community.
Yes.
I love that.
Fire Safe Council, everybody.
You're so excited about it, too. It's so fun to see how excited you are about it. This is a radio show, but I wish we had the visuals, because Allie's really excited about this, and I am as well. What about you, Ross?
I just appreciate you having me out. I appreciate you being as active as you are and really pushing for this. This really is a big deal. We need to burn off as much dead stuff as we can. We need healthier forests. I think ultimately that leads to a healthier community.
Healthier forest is a healthier community. Yeah. I like that. That'll be our tagline for this segment, Ross. I love that. All right. Thanks for coming in. Maybe on three, we can kind of try to do the traditional ecological knowledge on three. One, two, three.
Traditional ecological knowledge.
Wow, we're a great team. That was one take. One take only. We're one take only here on People Powered Radio. And we're one take because we made possible listeners like you and contributors. And by generous contributions of KZFR supporters, and by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Locally owned, Quicksilver provides reliable courier service for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality delivery service 24/7. And by Chico Sports LTD, a locally owned sporting goods store featuring bicycles, sports equipment, and apparel for all seasons since 1985. Chico Sports LTD is located in Safeway Plaza on Mangrove and is grateful for the support of local businesses and the community. Guillermo Mashier, kind of wrapping up here. Like every good story, we had the beginning, Allie Matters Night, kind of humanizing the work that she does. And we had a middle that you just heard, which was a healthier forest is a healthier community, a.k.a. a quote from Ross Brannon, a wildland firefighter. And we're going to end here with a really cool segment with Mel. It's going to start off with the segment I mentioned at the top of the hour that we are going to put in the extended, but you're going to learn a little bit about Mel and going to jump right into this interview. And I'm out of airtime, so I really appreciate everyone listening in. And make sure you listen in to Playing Dead, because I think they just walked in here on People Power Radio. All right, Guillermo Mesh here for the Black Friday edition of the Peace and Social Justice Show here on KZFR 90.1 FM. And I'm really pleased to have Mel Figueroa in the studio. And welcome to KZFR, Mel Figueroa.
Thanks, Guillermo.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I
I've had a very long, circuitous sort of way of getting here to Chico. I'm a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley. And actually, my dissertation research had been in forest ecology in the Amazon. I was actually studying how people who were on the edges of cities, like people who you would normally think of as in favelas, right? Mm-hmm. But that name kind of conjures up a very different picture than what I found in the Amazon. I'd been interested in studying a long time in like indigenous agriculture, agricultural practices, traditional knowledge, and actually how colonization imprints the landscape differently than the indigenous inhabitants did, mm-hmm. and what effect colonization has had on the ecology of certain places. I also was studying a lot of traditional knowledge, ethnobotany, agroforestry in particular. And for various reasons, I didn't continue that research. The 2016 election happened, and so I went into politics.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I don't know. No, but it was definitely an incredible life-changing experience. I was the national press director for Jill Stein and Ajamma Baraka's campaign, the Green Party presidential campaign in 2016. So I kind of had a front row seat to the most insane, electoral circus in recent memory.
Yeah.
So that was certainly my memory. That was certainly interesting. Mm-hmm. I went back to Berkeley after the election, and then the white supremacists came. And mm-hmm. like I said, for various reasons, I mean, there was a lot of circumstances, you know, put me out on the road going and organizing all over the country, but eventually coming here to Chico just a few months before the campfire. And so, you know, it was really just, I just needed to like regroup, mm-hmm. you know, kind of figure out where I was going to go from there. And then the fire happened, and you know, I ended up getting involved with so many of these wonderful groups that are doing work, you know, here at the edge of the canary in the coal mine of climate change. We're in a very unique position. I just say that the apocalypse isn't just, you know, a thing that happens that, you know, it's like a one final moment, but it's a series of moments.
Right.
It's almost like a comet, right, coming. Mm-hmm. And we just caught one early, a piece of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. But that puts us in a position to do something about it.
It sure does.
To be able to reimagine together what it would look like to, you know, to survive the apocalypse, mm-hmm. quite literally in our case, being in fire mm-hmm. country here, and all over Northern California. It's not just our problem. You know, we have a whole state that is facing a lot of challenges because of climate change, but also because of economic issues and the sort of end stage of capitalism, as I like to put it.
Well, I'm glad you're in Butte County in this moment in time, because your skill sets are certainly well established and well respected. All right, Guillermo Mash here for the Black Friday edition, 2019 edition of the Peace and Social Justice Show. And I'm taking full and complete advantage of this opportunity because I have Mel Figueroa and Ali Metters Knight here on a pre-record Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And I want to land on, you know, about this organization that you guys have started. As I understand it, you have a trailer that's your like home base that you guys are working out. But why don't we try to get our listeners engaged in understanding what you wonderful things you two are working on.
About 9 years ago, I went to the California Indian Manpower Consortium leadership training. That's a mouthful. And I worked on a business plan, and that business plan was called Indigenous Earth Relations Alliance. The following year or two, or about 3 years later, I was able to organize a conference at Chico State with the students during their This Way to Sustainability Week, Earth Week. And I was able to display and talk about my idea to create TEK certifications for tribal members and non-tribal members and go after sole source contracting for land management. And during that time, there were grants to go after, but they were for BLM lands, they were for very small areas, and there were 3 to 6, maybe 7-year contracts available. So I wasn't really able to get anyone to sign into them because the short term and such a labor force to be made for such a small projects. So in 2018, I was investigating, continuing on my passion to make these things happen years later. And I found that the 2018 Farm Bill had given a 20-year stewardship contract on the very same thing that I've been investigating all these years. So right now we're proposing that the Machupta Indian Tribe begin the process of creating an enterprise or a group to certify tribal members and non-tribal members for TEK certification and create a labor force and to subcontract these labor forces for all the federal lands in Butte County for the next 20 years.
TEK is teaching ecological knowledge?
Traditional ecological knowledge. So mm-hmm. traditional ecological knowledge is sort of to acknowledge that what indigenous people had built over the last 20,000 years on this continent isn't just about spiritual practice. It's not just about culture. It was a science and it was a scientific method that was practiced by indigenous peoples to manage their landscape. So part of what TEK is about is that we're used to thinking about domestication in terms of like one species, like a plant or an animal. What indigenous peoples did all over North and South America is what we call landscape domestication. So they weren't just hunter and gatherers, just, you know, living along the whims of nature. They shaped nature to mm-hmm. an incredible extent to improve hunting grounds, fishing weirs, gathering places. Doing that over and over, season after season, actually shaped the landscape that they lived in. And so the landscapes adapted to them as much as they adapted to the landscapes.
How much land is there in Butte County, federal land, that would be underneath this proposal?
About 180,000 acres.
Wow.
But and the capacity under this grant, this 20-year grant, is up to 3,000.
Up to 3,000, so you couldn't do the whole 180?
What we can do is subcontracts. So,
so 3,000 a contract. Okay.
There's a master stewardship contract, and then there's a number of subcontracts. Part of what the certification program is about is, again, getting people trained up in the skills and knowledge and also like kind of a perspective that's really needed to do forestry on like in the way that indigenous peoples did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thank goodness, again, like I'm coming to it with a academic perspective, but I also have, you know, lived in the forests with indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. I'm an indigenous person to the Philippines. That's where my right. family comes from. And a lot of my family memory comes from. So, you know, it's really about getting everybody. This is what decolonization means. It's not just decolonization on the side while everybody goes along with their colonized ways. It's literally giving indigenous authority its due
mm-hmm.
and being able to be okay, you know, letting non-white people call the shots.
So let's just talk a bit about the semantics. So if you can manage up to 3,000 acres, you know, you work through your certification process and you've got, you know, someone that's going to manage that 3,000 acres. Does the government, you know, have grants that you go after to help get money to maintain the land? How does the money flow?
So this is part of originally what I had even proposed through my first business plan was that we would able to create an economic base through all the supplies and goods found in the forest. So this would be a sustainability plan. So unlike getting a grant every year that you just draw down, say, $1 million to $2 million every year, and then you process and do your subcontractors, and you basically have to show dollar for dollar what was spent, and it's a very strange procurement. So this would actually allow all of the goods to be managed for the project.
Mm-hmm.
So the federal government basically pays the first phase of the project as you do setup, and then you should be sustaining yourself from then on.
Is there homesteading involved?
There absolutely should be. So similar to the CCC camps in the 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps, we would be doing workforce housing, not according to the extractive economy, but according to the needs of the land management. So there would be like riverine stations and forest stations and also the biomass, you know, as Ali said, the biomass and the goods that are collected from fuel removal and stuff can be used for timber for the housing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Even the clays could be used to make cob homes, which are fire resistant, by the way. You know, I mean, part of the sort of counterintuitive logic of fire adapted landscape like this is that in order to prevent wildfires, you have to move more people into the forest. The forest needs to be actively managed year over year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, where a lot of people are saying, oh, no growth in the urban wildland interface, we're actually saying we need the right kind of
right.
settlement on the urban wildland interface in order to make everybody safe.
What would this workforce housing look like? Kind of like the same as the CC model. Sometimes they'd set up camps, tents. Sometimes they'd build little cabins, all the above.
Well, because I'm looking at it from the tribal perspective as the lead agency, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the tribal government that we have, Machupta, which is a government, it mm-hmm. is a sovereign government, they would be developing their own building codes and regulations.
Got it. Okay.
That would be complementary to the city or county, but would probably be more accommodating to the supplies and things provided in the forest for a good reason.
I mean, do you have any specific plots in mind? A plot might not be the best way to describe 3,000 acres, but
yeah.
out of the 180,000, are there some prime spots you guys are looking at? Or
well, yeah, mm-hmm. right now, you know, the partner that we're working with a lot and talking a lot with is the Butte Fire Safe Council. They're the organization that has the most coordination right now. They've been on the land. They know it. You know, we're not like saying we're going to go for this particular thing right now. But, you know, I mean, it does kind of make sense right now to, you know, if Paradise and Magalia are like ways that, you know, we can look. I mean, since that is Machupta territory and it is, you know, a place that is in need of smart rebuilding.
Way.
Very smart rebuilding. It's kind of this thing of how do we move forward in a new way from this disaster? And, you know, this is one of the opportunities that we have to, again, reestablish a relationship with the landscape that is adaptive and is not driven just by the needs of a market, but by the needs of our ecological survival. It's going to be a lot of conversations. It's going to be a lot of being able to sort of prove what we already know intuitively right. to be true. And it's a lot of fight for that kind of funding. And that's why, again, this goods for services thing is very important, so that we would have the freedom to experiment and be able to come up with really what's the best practice, not based on what we've always done so far, but of what we need to do in order to survive.
It'd be nice putting the federal government on the spot, because they keep saying we need to manage the federal lands better. There you go.
We're kind of taking him at his word.
Yeah. Maybe we can land before we close on how folks can get involved or learn more or all of the above.
So the progress right now, we're pretty much in phase one. We've met with the county. We've meeting with Fire Safe Council. We're meeting with any and every entity that is willing to reach out. TEKstewardship@gmail.com. It's TEKstewardship@gmail.com. is a way to contact us, and we're together just making meetings and collaborating. We're also bringing those partnerships and collaborations with the tribe, the Machupta Indian tribe. We're in the first phase of that. We'll be doing outreach to other tribes, not only in our area, but other tribes who have experience with traditional ecological programs, who also have done traditional fires, and who have done stewardship programs through the Farm Bill in the past. And we definitely want to collect all that data. The grant is due in August 2020.
So we would just Google Farm Bill 2019 to find the actual bill?
If you go to the U.S. Forest Service website and look up stewardship contracting, there are resources there. There's some PowerPoint presentations where, you know, kind of shows you sort of the basics of it, and a brochure that basically says what the stewardship contract is.
And we're going for the 20-year end result stewardship contracting specifically.
Nice. I think I'll still be around. I won't be quite 80, but I'll still be around. I really appreciate all that you folks are doing. Any closing comments?
Just that, you know, 20 years is like, you know,
nothing.
The thing is that we need to start now,
yeah.
right? And that's part of it. We're trying to really, you know, in this moment where all of us are in the same place of trying to figure out what to do now that, you know, the reality of climate change has really kind of hit us, right? Is, you know, being able to use this moment where we're all searching to be able to, you know, start something now, mm-hmm. because we can't wait for 20 years. No. We can't wait until another three fires have burned through here or it's been flooded out. You know, we got the first rain on November 27th.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's starting now. And so we need to move now because it will take a while for these results to show themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so nice. It's a slow but steady process, not usually one we're used to, but one we have to just keep working at.
Slow and steady wins the race.
That's right.
Thank you, ladies.
Water so deep, water so wide, water braiding the earth and the sky. Mountains so strong, mountains so tall, lifted by spirit and holding the song.
You know what the deal is, guys. That's right. It's time for another one of your KZFR 90.1 FM community calendars. Saturday, November 30th, the Chico Arts Center will be hosting The Gift Show. This event will take place at 10 a.m. at the Chico Arts Center, located at 450 Orange Street, right here in Chico. For more information, reach out to the Chico Arts Center at chicoartscenter.com or 530-895-8726. Monday, December 1st, Enloe Medical Center was named one of America's 100 best hospitals for general surgery and gastrointestinal care, according to the national study by HealthGrades. In addition, Enloe will also be hosting multiple community and support group events throughout the month of December. For more information on these events or Enloe's top 100 rating, call 530-809-6083 or visit the website at www.enloe.org. Tuesday, December 3rd, the Museum of Northern California Art, or MONCA, has a very busy month with December coming up. This is a list of all their events. Tuesday, December 3rd, from 6 to 8, they have a clothing swap. Saturday, December 6th, a yoga with Tom Hess. Sunday, December 8th, an artist panel. Wednesday, December 11th, a holiday art writing night. Saturday, December 14th, a Christmas jug band. And Tuesday, December 31st, a New Year's Eve party. For more information on MONCA's events and everything they got going on, feel free to reach out to them at 530-343-9778. And last but not least, Sunday, December 8th, the Chico Women's Club will be hosting a Winter Soul Fest event. This event will take place from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Chico Women's Club right here in Chico. For more information, reach out to the Chico Women's Club at 530-933-6433. All right, guys, that is my time. If you feel like there is an event that isn't on here but should be, feel free to reach out to us at cc@kzfr.org. From the West Side with love, happy holidays, everyone. Peace.
All righty, you are tuned to listener-supported community radio, 90.1 KZFR Chico. My name's Ray. It is time for Playing Dead, the Thanksgiving edition. So, got a fun show.